Hello and welcome to Big Ideas on RN and online at abc.net.au/RN. Paul Barclay with you. Being different, not part of the mainstream, author Andrew Solomon has lived this in his own life, and it's the subject of his latest book, Far From the Tree. From childhood, Andrew Solomon was bullied for being gay, underwent therapy to try to be straight, was diagnosed with depression, and then finally, in middle age, made peace with his true identity. It sparked an interest in how others deal with their own, sometimes extreme, adversity, who nonetheless emerge phoenix-like from the flames. In his book, Far From the Tree, Solomon tells the stories of hundreds of families affected by disability and the way parents respond to the challenge of building a life for their children. Also, the challenge of making meaning out of their own life, which is turned upside down in the daily struggle. Andrew Solomon gave the opening address at the recent Sydney Writers Festival. He relates heart-rending stories from his book and also tells candid personal stories. The bully on the school bus who made Andrew's journey to and from school a daily misery. His experience of therapy in the quest to change his sexuality and his battle with depression. Too depressed to perform simple tasks, Andrew argues the opposite of depression is not happiness, but vitality. Now married to his partner, he nonetheless says he was reluctant to embrace identity politics and the gay pride movement. Andrew hopes that someday being gay will be a simple fact, free of party hats and blame, but he says we're not there yet. Here is author Andrew Solomon at the Sydney Writers' Festival.
As a student of adversity, I've long been struck by the way that some people with major challenges seem to draw strength from them, while other people with exactly the same challenges seem to be entirely defeated by them. And I've long been in touch with the popular wisdom that says that it's a matter of finding meaning. And for a long time, I thought that meaning was out there waiting to be found, some deep truth that some people could gain access to and that eluded others. But over time, I've come to feel that the truth is irrelevant. We call it finding meaning, but we might better call it forging meaning, because finding it actually matters less than seeking it. My most recent book, as Gemma mentioned, is about families. It's about how families respond to having children who are different in a whole variety of ways. The attitude that those people reflect and that the book reflects altogether was one that was tied around this idea of forging meaning. And I think often of one mother I got to be very close to. She and her husband had a child with multiple severe disabilities. They were told that it was a genetic fluke. They had a second child who was born with exactly the same syndrome. And they had done an extraordinary job in taking care of these children who never were able to walk any significant distance, who never were able to talk, who never developed many of the functions we associate with being human. But the mother said to me, when I was asking her about how they had managed to do so well under the circumstances, she said, "People always give us these little expressions like, 'God doesn't give you any more than you can handle.' But children like ours are not preordained as a gift. They're a gift because that's what we have chosen. And I believe that we make those choices all our lives." When I was in second grade, which is to say about 7 years old, Bobby Finkel had a birthday party, and he invited everyone in the class but me. And my mother called Mrs. Finkel, assuming there'd been some sort of a mistake. And Mrs. Finkel said that Bobby didn't like me and he didn't want me at his birthday party. And I remember that day my mother taking me out to the zoo and for a hot fudge sundae when everyone else was heading over with their presents. When I was in seventh grade, an older kid on the school bus that I took nicknamed me Percy as a shorthand for what he saw as my unmasculine demeanor. And sometimes he and his cohort would chant that provocation the entire length of the bus ride, 45 minutes to school, 45 minutes back. Percy, 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 Percy. Eventually they got a chaperone on the bus and the chanting stopped. But kids still called me faggot, often within hearing distance of teachers who did nothing about it. Our eighth grade science teacher told us that all gay men develop fecal incontinence because of the trauma they endure to their anal sphincter. And I, yes, it's true. And I managed to graduate high school without ever going into the cafeteria, where I would either have sat with the girls and been laughed at for doing so, or sat with the boys and been laughed at for being the sort of boy who should sit with the girls. And I survived that childhood through a mix of avoidance and endurance, avoiding the taunts when I could, enduring the taunts when I couldn't. What I didn't know then, but I know now, is that avoidance and endurance can be an entryway to great meaning. After you forge meaning out of your adverse experiences, you must build an identity. You recognize your traumas as part of who you have come to be, and you fold the worst events of your life into a narrative of triumph, evincing a better self in response to things that hurt. In my book work, I found that how one deals with these things, especially as a parent, has enormous ongoing significance and effects. So parents who think that parenting a different or disabled child has given them a rich experience they'd never otherwise have had are able to lead lives which have shape and structure and even joy in them. And parents who can't don't. And that makes a difference for the parents. But there also have been a couple of recent studies. One that showed that mothers who are rated as optimistic shortly after giving birth to children with special challenges were compared to a control group of mothers rated as pessimistic when they had children born with the same challenges. 2 years later on, the mothers rated as optimistic had children who were doing better. And a recent study of children with various birth complexities and challenges found simply the mothers who had tried harder to find meaning had better outcomes. So I thought about that a lot as I met the men and women of my book. And I'll tell you about Betty Adelson, who's a remarkable woman who had a daughter who is a dwarf and who went through the whole experience of coming to terms with what it meant to have a child who is so different from anything she'd anticipated or experienced. But she threw herself into that life. She became a member of the Little People of America and served on its executive committee. She wrote two books about dwarfism, which really are the definitive books on the subject. And I said to her at one point, "How do you feel about it?" And she said of her daughter, who had finally found love after a very rocky stretch, she said, "She loves and is loved well, as I had hoped. If she had been average, would my world have been narrower? Yes, I recognize the gift that's been given. If someone had said to me, 'How'd you like to give birth to a lesbian dwarf?' I wouldn't have checked that box." But she is Anna, the cornerstone of the family. I wish the road had not been so steep for her, but I'm glad she managed to climb it with grace. I'll tell you about another one of the families I looked at. I have a chapter in my book on families bring up children conceived in rape, because the circumstance of where your child comes from can be its own trauma sufficient very much to complicate the experience of being a parent. And so I interviewed a woman whom I've called Brenda, who was brutally raped when she was 16, pulled into the back of a taxi, became pregnant, came from a very Catholic family, didn't contemplate terminating the pregnancy, had this child. The experience destroyed her career ambitions. It destroyed her social experience. It prevented her from entering into the kind of marriage she might otherwise have entered into. The level of disruption it caused is beyond reckoning. It destroyed her sense of personal boundaries and complicated all her human interactions. But when I met her, she was 50. And I said to her, "Do you often think about the man who raped you?" And she said, "You know, I used to think of him all the time with anger. She said, but now only with pity. And I thought she meant pity because he was so unevolved as to do this terrible thing. And I said, pity? And she said, yes. She said, because he has a beautiful daughter and two beautiful grandchildren, and he doesn't know that, and I do. So as it turns out, I'm the lucky one. Some of our struggles are things that you're born to. Your gender, your sexuality, your race, your disability. And some are things that happen to you. Being a political prisoner, being a rape victim, being a tsunami survivor. We end up assuming many of those woes as identity, and doing so dispels the sense of isolation that can come with those experiences, because identity is a matter of finding community. It's a matter of gathering strength from that community and of giving strength to that community. It's changing an and for a but, saying not, I'm here, but I have cancer, but rather, I have cancer, and I am here. When we're ashamed, we can't tell our stories, and stories are the foundation of identity. So forge meaning, build identity. Forge meaning, build identity. That became a mantra for me. Forging meaning is about changing the world, and building identity is about changing yourself in the world. And it reflects on a choice that those of us with stigmatized identities have to make every day. How much to accommodate society by constraining ourselves, and how much to break the limits of what constitutes a valid life. Finding meaning and building identity does not make what was wrong right. It only makes what was wrong precious. In January of this year, I traveled to Myanmar to interview ex-political prisoners, and I was surprised to find them less bitter than I had anticipated. Most of them had knowingly committed the offenses that outraged the dictatorship in that country. They had walked into prison with their heads held high, and they walked out, often decades later, with their heads still held high. And I interviewed Dr. Ma Thi Da, who's a leading Burmese human rights activist, and who was in jail for many years, and who nearly died there, and who spent a long time in solitary confinement. And I asked her what she thought, and she said that she was actually grateful to her jailers. She said they had given her time to think, to grow, to meditate. I was surprised by how much people accepted their experience of going to prison, but I was also surprised that the story I had come to report, the glorious changes taking place in Myanmar, had not given these people as much pleasure as I'd anticipated. And Ma Thi Da said to me, we Burmese are very good at grace under pressure, but we're also very good at grievance under glamour. And the fact that the dictators have made these concessions doesn't blind us to all the problems we learned to understand so well while we were in prison. She was someone who had sought meaning and made her travails into a crucial identity. And I understood her to be saying that while the concessions that had been made conferred a little humanity, that was almost pointless where full humanity was deserved. That crumbs are not equivalent to a place at the table. I realized then that you can forge meaning and build identity and still be mad as hell. I've never been raped. I've never been in anything remotely resembling a Burmese prison. But as a gay person, I've encountered prejudice and even hatred. And I've forged meaning. And I've built identity, which is a move I learned from people who had endured far worse privations than mine. Yet I used to deplore identity politics. It felt to me like a means of celebrating to distract yourself from the things that you wanted to cry about. And I saw nothing to celebrate when I was younger in my own deviations from the mainstream. I, in fact, went to extraordinary lengths to try to be straight and enrolled myself in something called sexual surrogacy therapy, in which people I was encouraged to call doctors prescribed what I was encouraged to call exercises with people I was encouraged to call surrogates, who were not exactly prostitutes, but who were also not exactly anything else. And my particular favorite among them was a blonde woman from the American Deep South, who I got on with well, who finally admitted to me that she was actually a necrophiliac who had taken this job after she got in trouble down at the morgue. Those experiences, my surrogacy experiences, actually were helpful to me in a way and allowed me later on to have some very happy physical relationships with women. But I still felt all the time that I was at war with myself. And in retrospect, I can see that I was digging wounds into my own psyche. In my late 20s, I developed acute clinical depression. I've often said that the opposite of depression is not happiness, but vitality. And it was vitality that seemed to seep away from me. Everything just began to feel like too much work and more than I could do. I would get home and find that there were messages on my answering machine. And instead of thinking, oh, how great that those people called, I would think, what a lot of messages to have to return. What a lot of people to have to call back. Or I would decide that I should get up and take a shower. And I would think of all the steps involved, getting out of bed, walking to the bathroom, turning on the water, getting underneath it, finding the shampoo, putting it in my hair, and it felt to me like the stations of the cross. And one of the things that people often miss in conversations about depression is an understanding that while you're in it, you know that it's ridiculous. You know that other people return their phone calls and take a shower and make themselves lunch and do everything else they need to do without giving the matter a second's thought. And yet, the impossibility of every single thing pervades all of your consciousness. And as mine went on, I found myself first doing less, then thinking less, and then feeling less. And then the acute anxiety set in. And I would say, if you told me that I had to be depressed for the next month, I would say, well, if it's only a month, I think I can do that. But if you said I had to have acute anxiety for the next month, I would run and throw myself off the harbor bridge, because the idea of having that kind of acute anxiety for that length of time is so awful. It's like the feeling you have if you slip and trip in the minute before you hit the ground. But instead of lasting for a few seconds, it lasts day after week after month. You feel afraid all the time, but you don't know what it is you're afraid of. You feel like you're going to explode, and you feel like being alive is simply too painful. And finally, there was one day when I woke up, and I thought, I've never felt this bad in my life. And I thought, I should really make a call and get help. And I tried to reach for the phone, and I thought maybe I'd had a stroke because I couldn't do it. And I lay there in bed, staring at that phone for half an hour, and then another half an hour, and then another one. And finally, the phone rang, and I managed to answer it. And it was my father. And I said, I'm in terrible trouble. I need some kind of help. And he came down to get me, and it was at that point that I began on the medication and therapy that effectively saved my life. But like everyone else, I didn't like being on medication, and I didn't much like being in therapy. I thought, who am I? Are these drugs making me more myself, or are they making me into someone else? I knew that I had a nice life and I had access to good treatment, so I got better relatively soon. And then I went off everything and I relapsed. And then I went back and I got better. And then I went off everything and I relapsed. And I recovered and relapsed about 6 times before I finally understood that this was to be a life's project, managing this, and that I wouldn't be doing it on my own. Depression was hardly an identity I'd sought or that I would seek. But I found that one's identity can rise from what happens biologically, and that if you acknowledge your condition as an identity, It provides, at the very least, an excuse to be open. Depression, it seems to me, is the family secret that everyone has. The ubiquity of depression is so overwhelming. Since I started speaking publicly about it, almost everyone I meet says, I've had this problem, or I'm worried about my sister, or my husband has been going through something, I don't know what it is, or I don't know what's happening to my kids. The sort of sheer scale of it is extraordinary, and trying to keep it a secret from all the other people whom it also affects seems to me to be an exhausting enterprise. Now, shortly after I'd written my original piece about depression, which I did as an article for The New Yorker, I was at a conference, and it was a weekend-long conference, and on Friday of that weekend, a woman took me aside, and she said, please don't tell anyone about this, and especially don't tell my husband. He's a guy who just wouldn't understand it. But I've been dealing with depression, and I've just started taking this medication, and I wanted to find out what you think, and so I gave her whatever advice I could. On Sunday of that same conference, her husband took me aside, and he said, my wife wouldn't think I was really a guy if she knew this, but I've actually been dealing with depression, and it turned out that they were taking the same medication and hiding it in two different places in the same bedroom. I posited that issues of communication within the marriage might be contributing to the problem. But depression is so exhausting, and that silence makes it worse. And what I found when I tried to look at the mechanisms of resilience is that the people who turn away from their depression are ironically the ones who are most enslaved by it, the ones who say, I had that, I don't ever want to think about it again, it's over, it's behind me. They're the ones who live in a kind of constant terror that it will come again. And the people who say, I certainly would not have chosen this, but it is what happened to me, and I have incorporated it into a coherent life narrative, those are the people who manage somehow not to avoid the next relapse, but to be a little bit better prepared for it, to find it a lot easier to tolerate. I think that the incorporation of your depression in that way makes it bearable. Shutting out the depression strengthens it, and bringing it out does not. I had been in a closet, and I was determined never to be in another closet again, which is perhaps why I'm talking about this so openly from a large stage in Sydney. I've said that the opposite of depression is not happiness but vitality, and since the time when I was depressed, I'm so aware of my own vitality, such as it is, every day that I have it, in a way I wouldn't have been if it weren't for that surprising moment 20 years ago when hell came to pay me a visit. I'm no longer sad about having to take a shower or about the messages on my answering machine. I'm sad about failed relationships and professional disappointments and global warming, and I can be more sad than I was when I was depressed because my sadness is not mediated by that terrible nullity. And in the face of those sadnesses, those very real sadnesses in some instances, I also find and cling to reasons of joy in a way I never would have otherwise, and gamely side each day with the reasons for living, which I think is a privileged rapture. Ovid once said, "Welcome this pain, for you will learn from it." And I always thought he might have said, "Welcome this pain and determine yourself to learn from it." We don't seek the painful experiences that hew our identities, but we do seek our identities in the wake of painful experiences. We cannot bear a pointless torment, but we can endure great pain so long as we know it to be purposeful. Ease makes less of an impression on us than struggle. We could have been ourselves without our delights, but not without the misfortunes that drive our search for meaning. I used to think that the nature of the challenge was extremely important, and I wrote a lot about how I loved my depression because it had tested my mettle and made me into who I am. But I now think I could have had the same experience from having a child with Down syndrome, or from having cancer, or from 1,000 other difficulties, because it's not the suffering that is precious, It's the concentric pearlescence in which we contain it. That raw grid of anguish will never be in short supply. There's enough of it in the happiest life to serve these instructive purposes, and there always will be. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, wrote St. Paul in 2 Corinthians, for when I am weak, then I am strong. In 1988, I got a magazine assignment to go to Moscow to write about the artists of the Soviet avant-garde. And I went expecting their work to be dissident and political, but it wasn't. It was humanistic, and its radicalism lay in trying to wrest humanism out of the hands of a dehumanizing system of government and a dehumanizing society. And when I talked to the artists about what they were doing, they talked about it in those high moral terms. They talked about the idea that they were safeguarding truth, which is what some of them have to do in Russia again today. One of them said to me, "We were in training to be not artists, but angels. For them, being an artist was not a trade, but an identity." In 1991, I was back in Moscow, staying with my artist friends during the putsch that ended the Soviet Union, and they were among the people who organized the resistance to those attacks, helping to build the barricades that went up all over Moscow. It was an amazing time to be with them, and full of wonderful and in some instances hilarious events. I particularly remember that there was a large Russian woman who had managed to jumpstart some construction equipment in order to move some of the barricade materials. She was operating with a lot of levers and things and didn't quite know what she was doing, and she was screaming at people the whole time what to do, wearing in that way that people do like to wear t-shirts in foreign languages they don't speak without really knowing what they mean. She had on a t-shirt that said, "I'd rather be playing tennis." On the third day of the putsch, one of the artists I was with suggested we walk up to Smolenskaya, which was where the only three people who died in that operation had gone down the night before. And we walked up there, and it was a Russian scene. There were old women standing around speaking about tragedy. There were flowers on the ground. And suddenly a young man who looked sort of like the student from a Chekhov play with a tweed cap and little wire-rimmed glasses came running up, and he said, "Come on up to the front barricade, there are tanks approaching." Well, there had been tanks approaching the barricades from time to time, and none of them had done anything. So we walked up to the barricade, and we ranged ourselves in front of it, hand in hand, all of us by that time coming down with colds. It was cold, it was wet, it was a miserable day. And the soldier on the front tank, when the column of tanks rolled up, said, "We have been given unconditional orders to destroy this barricade. And if you move out of the way, we won't have to hurt you. But if you don't, we'll have no choice but to run you down." And the artist said, "Give us just a minute. Give us just 1 minute to let you know why we're here." And they began into a Jeffersonian panegyric to democracy, of a kind that those who live in Jeffersonian or parliamentary democracies would mostly be incapable. And they talked about freedom and what it was and what it felt like. And they went on for about 15 minutes, and then they stopped. And the soldier sat there with his arms still folded, and he sat there in silence for a full minute. And then he said, "What you have said is true, and I must bow to the will of the people. If you clear enough space for us to turn around, we'll go back and leave you your barricade." That was the day that the putsch collapsed. And I remember thinking that sometimes forging meaning and building identity gives people the vocabulary they need to win their ultimate freedom.
Author Andrew Solomon giving the opening address at the Sydney Writers' Festival. You're listening to Big Ideas on RN. I'm Paul Barclay. In telling these harrowing stories, Andrew Solomon says he doesn't want to romanticise suffering, but confirm that people are strengthened by what life throws at them. Faced with pain and struggle, they search for the positive rather than dwell on the negatives of their situation. Here's more from Andrew Solomon.
Russia awakened me to this lemonade notion that oppression breeds the power to oppose it. And I gradually understood that as the cornerstone of identity. A group of people is oppressed, a rare few turn that oppression into a source of strength, and others benefit from the acts of that empowered few. As soon as you find worth in your subjugation, you're building an identity, and identity is a safe harbor. We find our shape through conflict. I'll tell you about another one of the dwarfs I spent time with. This is a young woman named Kiki Peck. I spent time with her and with her family, including her mother, whose name is Chrissy. And a little while after I met them, Chrissy developed breast cancer. And she called her children in, and she told them that she had cancer, that she was going to be fine, that she needed to have treatment, and that before starting chemotherapy, she was going to have to shave her head. And Kiki, who was 9, said, "Well, I'll help you shave your head." Her mother said, "Okay." Kiki has something called kinesthesia dysplasia that affects cartilage. It means that not only is she of diminutive size, but she has compromised eyesight and terrible rheumatic joints, which are very painful and difficult to move. So Kiki helped her mother shave her head. And then when they'd finished, Kiki said, "Okay, and now I'm going to shave my head." And her mother said, "What are you talking about? Why on earth would you do something like that? No, don't do that." And Kiki said, "I've spent a lot of time being different all by myself, and I know how lonely it can be. And I would like you to have someone else who's different the same way you are at the same time." And she insisted on doing it. Now, this was a 9-year-old, and I thought, like those Russian artists, she was not only someone who had managed despite having terrible challenges, she was someone who had managed to become nobler as a consequence of them. She reminded me of my own mother's turning of her battle with cancer into an occasion for dignity, an event that I remember well and about which I've written another book. I should add a caution here. I don't want to make a carnival out of anguish. Most suffering is inherently meaningless, and we're well advised not to seek it out. There's a lot of meaning in joy, too. And meaning, in any case, is not the be-all and end-all of experience. So I don't want to romanticize awful experiences. And frankly, I don't recommend developing depression or losing loved ones or having a stigmatized identity or achieving poverty and woe or coming to close terms with one's own mortality. Avoid all of those if you can. But I do commend the people who, when confronted with such challenges, construct dignity around them. The Gnostic Gospel of St. Thomas, one of the apocryphal books, Jesus says, "If you will bring forth what is within you, then what is within you will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, then what is within you will destroy you." And I have so often wished that those were canonical words, because it seems to me that discovering identity is what rescued me from sadness. The gay rights movement posits a world in which my aberrances are a victory. Identity politics works on 2 fronts. It gives the people directly affected by a condition a sense of pride in it, and it causes the people outside that identity group to treat them more justly and more generously. And while those are 2 separate activities, advances in each sphere reverberate in the other. Those of us with stigmatized identities are constantly thinking through how much to change ourselves, how much to expand what it is to be human. Now, identity politics can be intensely narcissistic. People extol a difference only because it's theirs. They narrow the world and function in discrete groups without empathy for one another. They vote short-sightedly on single issues, but properly understood and wisely practiced, identity can expand our idea of what it is to be human. Identity should be not a smug label or a gold medal, but a revolution. The Spanish philosopher Miguel de Unamuno said, "It is not usually our ideas that make us pessimists or optimists, but it is our optimism or pessimism that makes our ideas." And I was struck in the research I did when I discovered that people who have a condition that they believe may be curable are in general less happy than people with a condition that they know to be incurable. Because those who believe their condition may be ameliorated don't live in the present tense. They live in the tense of those future hopes. And the people who know that things aren't going to change begin the path to self-acceptance and discover that it's often more profitable to accept yourself than to change yourself. When I worked for a while in a juvenile prison while I was doing the research for Far From the Tree, there was a long-serving woman correctional officer there working with juvenile felons, and her line was, "You gotta take your mess and find yourself a message." Which I thought was very sound advice. So I would have had an easier life if I were straight, but I wouldn't be me. And I now like being myself better than I like the idea of being someone else. Someone who, to be perfectly honest, I can't be and can't even really imagine. But there's nothing more ennobling than a great enemy. No patriotism so sweet as that hatched in wartime. If you banish the dragons, you banish the heroes. And we become attached to the heroic strain in our own lives. I have nevertheless sometimes wondered whether I could have ceased to hate that part of myself without Gay Pride's technicolor fiesta, of which this speech is one manifestation. And I used to think that I would know myself to be mature when I could simply be gay without emphasis. But those years of self-loathing created a void, and celebration needs to fill and overflow it. And even if I address my private debt of melancholy, there's still an outer world of homophobia and prejudice that will take decades to fill. So someday, perhaps being gay will be a simple fact, free of party hats and blame. But not yet. A good friend who thought Gay Pride was getting a little carried away with itself once suggested that we organize Gay Humility Week. It's a great idea. But its time hasn't yet come. Gay marriage seems to have stalled here in Australia. In the United States, gay marriage became legal in two more states today. But in general, there are 29 states left in the U.S. where I could still be fired or denied housing for being gay. Russia's anti-gay propaganda law has led to people being attacked in the streets. 27 African countries have passed anti-sodomy laws. And in Nigeria, gay people can legally be stoned to death, and lynchings are commonplace. In Zimbabwe, the president has referred to gay people as filth and threatened to behead them all. In Saudi Arabia, two men who were caught with each other were subjected to 7,000 lashes each and are both permanently disabled as a result of that. And India's highest court recently said that gay sex is still illegal. So who can forge meaning and build identity? That's still a rare luxury. As for people who are transgender, they face an even steeper set of challenges. When I was researching the trans community for my book, I heard two stories relatively close to each other that seemed to me to sum up the range of this experience. The first was a woman named Anne O'Hara. She had been the special needs teacher in a small town in the American rural South for many years and had taught a whole generation of the special needs children in her district. And one day a child was brought into her class who couldn't really talk, and she discovered that this child, who seemed to have some strange syndrome, was actually one of three children of a mother who had been prescribed antipsychotics, but instead of taking them herself, had fed them to her children to keep them sedated and kept those children tied to a pole in her house. And so Anne said, "I don't know what's wrong with this child, but it's not that he needs more medication. We need to get him over the experiences he's had." And a few weeks later, someone came in and said that they were going to take this child because the three children were being sent to foster homes in different parts of the state. And Anne said, "But you can't split up these three children. The only continuity they have is one another." And they said, "We have no place to put them together." And she said, "I'll adopt all three of them." And that's what she did. And in a few years, she had gotten all of them out of the special education track. And she discovered that the oldest one had ADD, and she got him medication for that. And she discovered that the middle one had childhood bipolar disorder, and she got him treated for that. And the youngest one just seemed sad all the time. And finally, one day, she was sitting with him, looking out of their porch, and he said, "Mom, I can't do it anymore. I can't keep pretending to be a boy. You know I'm really a girl. You must have always known I'm a girl. Look at me. Don't you think I'm a girl?" Well, Anne was completely taken aback. She'd never heard anything like this. But it went on, and her child, Carrie, kept saying this over and over again. And finally, after it had gone on for some time, she said she did some internet research. She found out what transgenderism was. She took her child to see a therapist in Nashville, Tennessee, which was the closest big city, who said, "Yes, your child is transgender." And so she said, "All right, finish out the school year as a boy, and I will allow you to live as a girl for 1 week after that, and we'll see how it goes." And she said in that week, the transformation in her child was so amazing that she didn't even recognize the person who was there. He went from being a morose, unhappy little boy to being an exuberant, joyful little girl who was running around and playing games and having a great time. And she said she knew she could never make her child go back, and her husband knew the same thing. So she went to the school where she had taught for 20 years, and she went to see the headmistress, and she said, "I wanted to let you know that when Carrie comes back to school in the fall, he actually won't be Carrie, she'll be a girl, and we're calling her Kelly, and it's called transgenderism, and here's a book about it, and I just wanted to let you know so that we could get everything prepared." And she said by the time she got home, the phone calls had started from people saying they were going to take that child and raise him upright, by people saying they would make that child into the girl she thought she was, by people saying that they were going to kill Anne and her husband. She said she'd never had anything like it, and she slept that night in front of the door with a shotgun in her lap. And the next day, her pediatrician called her and said, "The conversation around the pool isn't about whether to kill your child. It's about when to kill your child and what to use to do it. And so I would suggest, if you have any feeling for that child, that you get out of this town as fast as you can." And Anne went home, and she packed up her car with as much as she could fit, and she took her three children, and she drove away from that town, never to go back again. Her husband stayed behind because they needed the income from his job and because they needed his health insurance. And when he came back from work the following day, their family dog had been disemboweled and nailed to the fence outside their house with the message that their child was next. Anne found her way to another city. She found her way there in part because she had met someone online who also had a trans child. When she got there, she couldn't get a job teaching special needs children because those jobs require references, and she didn't want anyone in her old town to have any idea where she was. So she got a job cleaning the floors of a fast food restaurant instead, and was living on a pittance. And when I went to talk to her about it and met her in the trailer where she was based, she said, "I don't love my daughter less for mourning over this, but I miss my mom. I miss my sister. My daddy's grave is back there, and I just have to hope someone is putting flowers on it. I miss my dog. I miss my students. I feel really guilty because I'm still hung up on all this stuff that we left behind. I should just let that go. But it makes me so angry that these people have taken our lives from us." And then she sort of stopped, and she said, "But you can't grieve all the time when you've got your kids. You see how far they've come, and they reach you right in your heart. So regret? No. I miss the things that were in the old life. But if I knew this was going to happen, I would still adopt Kelly. Because honestly, if it weren't for Kelly coming into my life, I would have never entered this bigger, more beautiful world where I've met you and so many other wonderful people. I mean, if you just look at it, Kelly has brought more blessings into my life than I could possibly give back to her." Now, I twin that story with the story of Kim Reed, who was the transgender woman you saw in the video earlier. Kim had grown up in Helena, Montana, as a boy named Paul. She was quarterback on her high school football team. And she then went on and transitioned and felt she couldn't go home. And then she finally went back for her father's funeral, and she decided it was okay, and she decided to go back for her 20th high school reunion and to make a film about that experience. My particular favorite moment in that film is when she's talking to one of the other kids from her class who says, "But Kim, we've all changed." After the film was completed, the pastor in the church where she'd grown up invited her to come back and to do a special weekend in which they would show the film on Friday at the church, have seminars to discuss the issues in it on Saturday, and Kim would be invited to give the sermon on Sunday. And so they did that, and I was lucky enough to be there for that weekend and to spend that time with Kim and with the people in her community. And I'm going to read you just very briefly part of what she said in her sermon. She said, "The night before last, when our film was playing in here, I went outside to the columbarium where my father's ashes rest. As I was kneeling there by what I call Dad's spot, I thought of the hours and hours of videotape that he shot lovingly of me during my football games, and how much of the same footage was now being shown inside this sanctuary because I'd used it in my film. Now, it's certainly not the context that any of us expected, but I knew Dad would be proud. And just then, the dusk breeze blew in this waft of sound, and it was strangely familiar to me. And I realized it was the crosstown football game coming from the stadium. The band was playing, and the announcer was bellowing, and all of these old tapes were playing inside here on the screen. And I knew that new ones were being recorded just a few blocks away. Those recording their new memories to tape should be only so lucky as to be surprised by the last thing that they expected from their loved ones, only so fortunate as to get a chance to welcome them home with radical love. I thought about how all these cycles of lives would continue on, and so many aspects of my life coalesced in that one moment, that one beautiful, stunning, blessed moment, the past and the present, parent and child, male and female, the pain that life sometimes brings, and the soothing love that welcomes it with open arms after its exhausting journey into a distant country." So I would emphasize that gay rights and trans rights are not primarily marriage rights. They are the right to be Kim, accepted and protected, and not to be Kelly, driven out of his town and nearly her town and nearly destroyed by hatred. I would point out that millions of gay people live in unaccepting places or have no resources, and for them dignity can remain elusive. But every step forward is so sweet. In 2007, when we had been together for 6 years, my husband John and I decided to get married. Meeting John had been the discovery of great happiness and also the elimination of great unhappiness. And sometimes I was so occupied with the disappearance of all that pain that I forgot about the presence of joy, which was at first the less remarkable part of it to me. And marrying was a way to declare our love as more a presence than an absence. Marriage soon led us on to children, and that meant new meanings and new identities, ours and theirs. We not only care for our children because we love them, we also love them because we care for them. Their vulnerability seduces us. And so while I want my children to be happy, I love them because they are sad. I would take away their privation in any single instance, but I wouldn't want them to lose all of life's pain. As a gay father, I can teach them to own what is wrong in their lives. But if I succeed in sheltering them entirely from adversity, I think I will have failed as a parent. A Buddhist scholar whom I know once said to me that Westerners mistakenly think nirvana is what you arrive at when all your woes are behind you and you have only joy to look forward to. But he said that wouldn't be nirvana, because your current joy would always be shadowed by those past sadnesses. No, he said, nirvana is what you arrive at when you not only have only joy to look forward to, but when you also look back into the experiences that felt most painful as you lived them and see in them the seedlings of that happiness at which you've arrived. And I sometimes wonder whether I would have found so much fulfillment in marriage and children if they had come more readily, if I had been straight in my youth, or if I were young today. And perhaps they would. Perhaps all this complex imagining could have been applied to other topics. But if seeking meaning matters more than finding meaning, the question is not whether I'm happier for being a gay dad who got bullied, but whether assigning meaning to those experiences lets me be a better father. I tend to find the ecstasy hidden in ordinary joys because I didn't expect those joys to be ordinary to me. I found meaning in the surprise of gay marriage and gay family, which are still so breathtakingly new. This past October was my 50th birthday, and John and my family threw a party for me, something of a surprise party. And halfway through it, my son George, who's in the audience here this evening, said to my husband that he wanted to make a speech. And John said, "George, you can't make a speech. You are 5. Only Grandpa and Uncle David and I are making speeches tonight." But George insisted and insisted, and finally John took him up to the microphone in the front of the room. And George said, "Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please?" And everyone turned around, startled. And he said, "I'm glad it's Daddy's birthday. I'm glad we all get cake. And Daddy, if you were little, I'd be your friend." And in that moment, I thought to myself how indebted I was, even to Bobby Finkel, to all those early difficult experiences that had propelled me to this moment. And I was finally unconditionally grateful for a life I'd once have done anything to change. I'd said that and came up with that idea, and I was discussing it with a very old and beloved family friend. And he said to me, "But that's not really true." He said, "You're not glad about those painful experiences. You're deeply wounded by them permanently." And I thought, well, both things are true. So perhaps I should say that I'm not only wounded, but also very grateful. And that I think that's the definition of a good life with its range of experience. One in which you are not only wounded, but also have moved beyond those wounds. And I like the sadness that's in my past, though I frankly dread sadness in my future and feel I've had enough strengthening experiences to last me this lifetime.
American author Andrew Solomon at the Sydney Writers' Festival, talking about difference and disability. His most recent book is Far From the Tree, which won the American National Book Award.
Down in the meadow in a little bitty pool swam three little fishies and a mama fishy too.
The way the Andrews sisters go on, you'd think that all fish are friends, but they're not. In fact, there's a native perch and a European carp that are fighting each other for survival right now.
Oh, well, the carp are an environmental vandal, there's no doubt about it.
In fact, carp are like underwater rabbits. Let me, Anne Jones, translate the natural world for you. Off track, online, anytime at the RN website.